Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Is student loan debt creating a bubble? You know, like the mortgage loan bubble, and it's about to burst? My next guest argues that is the case. Glenn Reynolds, law professor at the University of Tennessee. Many of you know him as the popular blogger at Instapundit.com, Leaning Libertarian. He's written a short book now, part of a series of political pamphlets, actually, titled The Higher Education Bubble. Hi, Glenn. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, great. It's great to be back.
Let's define the word bubble first. What do you mean?
Well, typically you get a bubble when a lot of people, due to ignorance or misinformation or excessive optimism, think the return on an investment is going to be much higher in the future. And so they pile into it, whether it's tulips or subprime mortgages. And this happens until eventually people realize that they were over-optimistic, and then the bubble bursts. And you saw that with the housing bubble, where people thought that you could continue buying new houses with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances and all the things people want, and the price could go up faster than inflation year after year, and you could just make the difference up with debt. And that worked until it didn't work anymore, and all of a sudden housing prices plummeted, and a lot of people who had taken on a lot of debt and the expectation that it was going to make them a lot of money wound up just being stuck with a lot of debt, which is sort of the bad thing that happens when bubbles burst.
So what do you foresee? A lot of grads will default on their student loans, or people will stop going to college as much?
Well, probably some of both. I mean, already, actually, a lot of people are defaulting on student loans. The percentage of student loans that are non-performing now is shockingly high. And we are also seeing people at the same time deciding that they are going to go to a less expensive school. And in fact, Sallie Mae, the student loan people, just released a report yesterday saying that people are considering cost much more in deciding where to go to college, and that they are much more reluctant to take on debt, and also that parents are either less willing or less able to help students make up the difference.
So assuming those are sensible decisions, looking more for price and value in, you know, deciding which college to go to, that sounds sensible. What then, you know, what then would be a bubble bursting, and what would be the dire consequences, as we had dire consequences from the mortgage bubble bursting?
Well, the dire consequences, if you were investing in houses in, say, 2005, is that you borrowed a lot of money to buy a house at a high price, and now the house is worth less than you owe, and you are underwater, as they say. Now, the good news is, if you did that, I don't know how good, it's sort of good news, is you could always declare bankruptcy and get out from under it and declare a fresh start. On the other hand, if you invested six figures of debt into a college education in a field that won't get you a job, you are stuck with that debt, and you can't discharge it in bankruptcy, which means that it will follow you for life. And indeed, we hear a fair number of sad stories of people who borrowed a lot of money in college, graduated, can't get a job, or are working as baristas or waiters or something like that.
Some terrible stories,
but
the average student loan, from what I've read, is about, or the average student debt upon graduation is about $20,000, which over the course of a professional career, a college graduate career, is not actually that much, is it?
No, I think it's $27,000, but no, you're right. For the average person, the student loan debt is mostly a nuisance. But for the non-average person, and there are actually still a lot of those non-average people, the debt is very high, and you have a substantial percentage of people with debts, you know, in the six figures. And I think students, at least until recently, have been overly optimistic about what it's like to pay that debt off. I think a lot of people think that if you've got $100,000 in student loan debt and you can get a job that pays $100,000, you could just live on $50,000 and pay it off in 2 years. And I think they're astounded to discover that that's not really how things work in the real world.
They're forgetting about two things, taxes and lattes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Listeners, do you think we're in a higher education bubble? If so, what do you think the consequences are or should be? 212-433-WNYC. Or do you want to take a different position on what the situation is? From our guest, Glenn Reynolds, who has written a book, really a very short, like 40 pages political pamphlet that's part of a series that's coming out. This book is called The Higher Education Bubble, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Do you think this is good, bad, or neutral if it means fewer Americans go to college?
Well, I think it's kind of neutral. I mean, you know, we say everybody should go to college, and I guess the answer to that is to say, well, why? College is swell. I had a good time in college. I learned useful stuff in college. College is not the only way you can learn
useful
stuff.
Just so everybody knows, you then went to law school, and now you're a college professor at a law school, right?
That's right. I'm a law school professor. And I must tell you, the higher education bubble is biting much harder in my area, in legal education, than it is in undergraduate education so far.
And then the law is an interesting example to follow here because the legal profession entry-level jobs are so down from what they were in terms of number of jobs and what they pay, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's actually pretty appalling. The National Association for Law Placement says that the average starting salary for law graduates has dropped 35% over the past 2 years. And that's actually not the worst news, because the worst news is that only about 55% of law school graduates are actually getting legal jobs when they graduate.
Maybe there's a law school bubble, if nothing else.
There is. And actually, Brian Tominaha, who's a professor at Washington University Law School, has got a book called Failing Law Schools, which takes a very similar line to mine, but focuses specifically on legal education. And he argues that quite strongly.
But in terms of undergrads and the prospect of fewer people going to college at all, we have a bipartisan national economic policy of exporting low-skill jobs through globalization, free trade, and claiming that America's economic future is in high-skill jobs. Democrats say that, Republicans say that. If that's the policy, then aren't we obligated to get most young Americans through college?
Well, I don't know. You know, there are a lot of jobs that can't be exported and pay quite well that don't require college. And in fact, the Washington Post had a recent piece on a lot of people who even had college degrees, abandoning them to go into skilled trades, working as electricians or plumbers or things like that.
Right. And
you can make a lot of money.
I know.
It can't be outsourced.
Right. And people always say this, but there are only so many jobs for electricians and plumbers who, you know, serve their local communities out there. What we used to have in this country, in addition to that, was the mass assembly line, you know, factory level jobs that were that employed so many people in addition to the skilled trades. And those are the jobs that don't seem to exist anymore, that the country assumes will be replaced by high skilled jobs. Isn't that right?
Well, no, I think that's exactly right. I think there's a piece in The Atlantic last week called The Post-Employee Economy, which is basically, it's by Connor Senn, and it's basically about how many jobs are being automated to the point where they're highly profitable for the companies, but they don't generate very much in the way of actual employment,
right,
because they're being done by robots. And, you know, I joked some years ago, I, for one, welcome our new robot employees as long as they don't take my job.
Yes, or the, you know, the outsourcing of jobs, too. I mean, leave the Obama-Romney back and forth out of it, but the jobs are going somewhere, and for, you know, larger economic, through larger economic forces. But my question remains, doesn't that argue for having a national goal of getting many more Americans through college?
Well, the answer to that is no, not by itself, because, you know, people always say, well, if you go to college, you'll get a better job. People with college degrees earn more money. Well, you don't come out of college with a generic college degree. You come out of college with a degree in something. And the fact is the spread in terms of return on investment is pretty wide. So you go to college and you major in, say, electrical engineering, the odds are you're going to do pretty well. You go to college and major in, to pick somebody who was in a New York Times story a while back, religious and women's studies, and you may come out very well informed and erudite, and your life may be enriched, but your bottom line probably won't be, because that's not likely to get you a job.
Right.
So we have to not just say send people to college and let them take whatever they want. When college is as expensive as it is, and right now colleges, you know, even a relatively inexpensive college education costs something on the order of a Ferrari, it's got to produce enough of a return on investment to justify that expense. Otherwise, it's a luxury good, like a Ferrari, and we don't tell 18-year-olds to go out and borrow money to buy a Ferrari.
In a changing economic world, it certainly is a different challenge for liberal arts majors than it was in the past.
And I have to stress, because I think people tend to miss this, there's a lot of sort of STEM chauvinism where people say, you need to go into engineering, you need to go into science. That can be good. A rigorous traditional liberal arts degree is actually a great degree for being adaptable in a changing world. It's terrific to get. The problem is that a lot of people now graduate school, and they don't graduate with a rigorous traditional liberal arts degree. They graduate with a degree that really doesn't teach them anything that's of any particular value to employees.
We have
employers.
A full board of calls.
Oh, I'll bet you do.
I'll bet you bet right. And anytime we talk about student loans and higher education in general, one of the things we talk about a lot on this show, there are certainly people from, you know, from all phases of it, people yet applying to college, people are in college, recent grads, faculty members, everybody, because there is so much to say and so much change in this area. So if you're just joining us, my guest is Glenn Reynolds, who teaches law at the University of Tennessee and blogs at Instapundit. Maybe you know his very well-read libertarian-leaning blog, and now he's written a short book called The Higher Education Bubble. And Michelle in Wyckoff, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there. I'm in complete agreement with your guest today. I definitely think the cost of education is too high, and I think, you know, the government looks at so many other costs and not paying out, you know, per insurance companies, and they have this whole nationalized health care plan going on right now. Maybe they should start considering how much they offer to a loan, again, along the lines of return on investment. If you have somebody going for a liberal arts degree, maybe there's a cap that you can give out in loans, and maybe if we don't give out the loans at such high costs, maybe those prices will start coming down, and maybe universities should really start looking at technology and those online degrees and not charging the same amount for a class that you can get online. You can still get a degree, you can still get the learnings, but it can't be at this ridiculously high cost.
Michelle, thank you very much. Glenn?
Well, I mean, I think she's right. One of the things that's happened is the subsidies, of course, tend to drive the price up. If you're a university or a college right now, the more you charge for tuition, the more money you get. And in fact, at most of them, you know, the students go into the bursar's office or the financial aid office, and they sign the forms for student loans. And sometimes the check actually goes straight to the university. So it's a great deal for the university, and there's sort of no reason not to charge more. If students actually had to dig deep to pay for this stuff, or if they even just fully appreciated, as I think they're starting to, the burden of the student loans, there'd be a lot more downward pressure on tuition. And I don't see any reason why the federal government should offer a blank check on this. Brian Tominaha, in fact, suggests capping the total amount of student loans that an institution can receive in a given year or something like that to take away this incentive.
Let me play President Obama on this point, speaking to a group of University of Michigan students earlier this year about some of the measures his administration might take to fix the problem, and they run along these lines.
From now on, I'm telling Congress, we should steer federal campus-based aid to those colleges that keep tuition affordable, provide good value, serve their students well. We are putting colleges on notice. You can't assume that you'll just jack up tuition every single year. If you can't stop tuition from going up, then the funding you get from taxpayers each year will go down. We should push colleges to do better. We should hold them accountable if they don't.
Are you and the president on the same page, Glenn?
Yeah, pretty much. I think he's right about this. I think that you can't blame colleges for this, really. I mean, when it's raining soup, naturally everybody wants to grab a bucket. But I think that the fact is the subsidy has encouraged increases in prices that wind up burdening students. And then when the students can't pay, ultimately, since they're federally guaranteed loans, they burden the taxpayer. I favor having schools have some skin in the game by making them liable for a portion of the student loans if students aren't able to pay it. I would make them dischargeable in bankruptcy after, say, 5 or 10 years after graduation so people can't scam it. And I'd say if they're discharged, the college has to cough up, I don't know, 10%, 20% or whatever of that money back to the taxpayers. And that would strongly encourage colleges and universities not to have students take out too many loans in fields that aren't likely to generate a return.
Some say that's a Band-Aid solution and doesn't really get to the root of the problem.
I don't think the colleges will regard that as a Band-Aid at all.
All right, we're going to continue in a minute with Glenn Reynolds, author of the higher education bubble. More of your calls. We will replay, too, an exchange that some of you heard, a very interesting exchange that I had with the president of the University of Pennsylvania about this, and get Glenn Reynolds' take. And your calls, 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with University of Tennessee law professor and blogger at Instapundit, Glenn Reynolds, author of a new short book called The Higher Education Bubble. And a few weeks ago, I spoke with the University of Pennsylvania's president, Amy Gutman, who told me, in her opinion, high tuition is not the problem. Let's take a listen to our exchange.
The problem isn't the sticker price. The problem is the lack of need-based financial aid in this country. What everyone knows who goes to college is what really matters is what you pay and whether you can afford it. So affordability is the real problem, and you're absolutely right. If you increase tuitions and don't increase financial aid more than you increase tuition, then you have a real crisis of affordability.
I saw George Will on television the other day argue that the more you subsidize college education with financial aid, the higher the price is just going to go, because what you at the universities really look at is what families are willing to pay. So if they're willing to pay X and financial aid comes in, that's Y, you're going to charge X plus Y.
Yeah, that's just false. We have a policy, as do a group of universities that are committed to need-based financial aid. We have a policy that will meet the full need of all of our admitted undergraduates. We admit them without regard to their need. Once they're admitted, we look at their family's financial situation, and we meet their full need without any loans.
Amy Gutman, president of the University of Pennsylvania, on the show the other week. Glenn Reynolds, what did you think about that exchange?
I think you had it right there. And I have to say, one of the interesting things about financial aid is, first of all, most schools, when they give you your financial aid letter, they include a lot of loans. And loans are not financial aid. Loans are financial exploitation. Second of all, it's almost the only industry where they want you to file and give them all your tax returns and a statement of your net worth before they tell you what the price actually is. Because the price is what you're, as she says, is what you're paying. They decide what you are able to pay based on their own formula, which is not very generous, and they set the price accordingly. And if most industries that did that, that would be regarded as outrageous.
But
financial aid is really just price discrimination.
Although maybe she's right as far as her university goes, which is an Ivy League school that has relatively a lot of money and can do this needs-blind financial aid and admit people first. Now, clearly it's based on pre-calculations about what their likely expense in aid is. But isn't it a bigger problem at the universities that aren't as well as endowed or aren't as prestigious, where they just don't have the aid to give out, and they're still charging $50,000 a year?
Oh, absolutely, and that's the vast majority of private schools, certainly, because the number of schools that are rich enough to basically not really care what they get in tuition revenues, which is what you have to be need blind, is very few. It's perhaps a dozen, maybe a few more. The vast majority of schools don't have that luxury, and yet they charge just as much tuition, and it's expensive. And to go with something that the previous caller said, I'm not sure it has to be this expensive. I think there are probably a lot of ways to cut costs without necessarily cutting the actual education. And I will stress, too, that one of the main causes of the tuition increase is administrative bloat. And a study by the Goldwater Institute from last year said it was about 65% attributable to the growth in the numbers of administrators. And we now have, at many schools, more administrators than we have teaching faculty, which was not true as recently as 10 or 15 years ago. So that's one of the things driving tuition.
Let's get some more callers in here. Seema in North Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hello, Seema.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
My husband is actually a faculty at one of the universities, and he's been in academia for many years. And over the years, I've observed one thing, that it looks like there's a lot of expenditure on unnecessary things, you know, in, say, taking faculty out for lunch, various things. And I think somebody has to look at, even in state-sponsored universities, they have to look at the amount of expenditure that these departments have, and how, you know, what kind of expenditure it is. And also, you know, it looks like faculty salaries are pretty high. I mean, a person who just has a recent PhD gets far more than an older and an experienced professor. And that, I think, is a little, you know, unfair, because what exactly can, with the kind of education that they have, can they command $200,000 starting salary? I mean, does that, it doesn't make sense. So that's one other thing. And the other thing is, looks like there are a lot of universities seem to be selling their PhDs or, you know, advanced degrees to foreign students who are willing to pay the full price.
Hmm.
So that is sort of encroaching on American students, you know, trying to get admission into a lot of universities, good universities.
Thank you very much. Some more reasons that tuitions are high. Annette in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hello, Annette.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My question for your guest is, I have two related questions. The first question is, initially he stated that there was a shocking number of underperforming student loans. I'd like to know what a dollar figure and percentage figure that is. Secondly, how is there a mathematical equation that can be used to extrapolate and predict how many student loans will underperform or fail in the future?
The answer to your second question is almost certainly. That's an actuarial thing that I'm not qualified to answer. Here are some numbers, though, that I have in front of me. There's about $1 trillion of total student debt out there, and that's up by a factor of more than three since 2002, and it was $300 billion. Almost half of student borrowers are not making payments. Now, some of those are in school, and some of those are out and unable to pay. We have about $85 billion worth of past due payments right now, and what's really interesting is 66% of those comes from people 39 and younger. And actually, one thing that sort of ties these two things together is that the housing bubble and the student loan bubble is, if you're hoping for people to graduate from college, get jobs, make some money, and go out and buy houses and help dig us out from under the housing bubble, the problem you have is that a lot of those students are carrying sufficient amounts of student loan that they either can't qualify for a mortgage, or that they just don't really want to go into that kind of debt.
However,
so they feed on each other.
However, Glenn and Annette, thank you for your call. There are criticisms about comparing the housing and student debt crises, you know, and equating them too closely. And some of the stats in those criticisms say, at its peak, mortgage debt reached $20 trillion. By comparison, student loan outstanding debt is $1 trillion. Also, only 10% of recent graduates are defaulting on federal loans. It's a much larger percentage of homes that wound up underwater. So is it really a fair comparison?
I think it's a fair comparison. I mean, I think the magnitude is different. The nice thing about all those mortgages is they do represent a house which has some intrinsic underlying physical value, presumably, whereas an education may or may not have any actual intrinsic value at all. You can't sell it.
But what's the long-term unemployment rate of college graduates? It's not that high, is it?
No, but the new employment rate for recent college graduates is pretty bad. And, in fact, waiters with college degrees are up 81%. So, you know, that's from 2000 to 2010. So I think that's I think you have to ask what real value is added if you go into debt, get a college degree, and wind up waiting tables or working as a barista. I don't know why people always pick on the baristas in these examples. You know, or have some other job that you could have done just as easily without a college degree.
Last thing. Some people are calling for sort of bailout for students. I'm guessing that as a libertarian, you would hate this idea. But Representative Congressman Hanson Clark of Michigan is proposing a Student Loan Forgiveness Act that would forgive loan balances for students who make 10 years of payments that equal 10% of their income. What do you think about that?
I don't actually think that's such a horrible idea. I do oppose bailouts, but I think that, you know, if you had gone heavily into debt flipping houses in 2005 and then got caught when the bubble burst, you could go bankrupt and get a fresh start. And I don't see any particular reason to treat student loan debt differently from other debt. I think it's fine. You know, we did have this problem back in the 70s with people graduating medical school with no assets and not getting paid much in their residency and saying, hey, I owe a lot of money. I'm not making much money. I don't have any assets. I'll go bankrupt. And they adjusted the law to cover that. But I now think they've gone too far, and I think a 10-year window is not unreasonable. But I repeat, I think that the people who got that money up front should have some skin in the game.
Glenn Reynolds, University of Tennessee, law professor, blogger at Instapundit, and now the author of The Higher Education Bubble. Great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can keep this going on our webpage, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.